Conversation 8. I'm doing a survey on shopping habits. Would you mind answering a couple of quick questions?
Okay, as long as it doesn't take long.
How often do you eat hamburgers?
Never. I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat any animal products.
Right. Can I just ask you, are you wearing leather shoes?
Yes, I am.
Don't you think that's rather hypocritical?
No, not really.
I would have thought it was myself. Conversation 9.
Look at this. Sport on the front page of the newspapers again. It's ridiculous. Who cares which team won on Saturday?
Oh, come on, Laura. Just because you're not interested in football?
That's not the point. I just think that as a society, we spend far too much time talking about sport and not nearly enough time worrying about real issues.
I think Susan's got a point. Sport's a substitute for things that matter. A way of distracting us.
Conversation 10.
What is that music you're listening to?
It's Miles Davis. Do you like jazz?
No, it gives me a headache. I don't know what you see in it. Can't you play some decent music for a change? Mozart or Beethoven?
Sorry, I don't have any classical music.
Unit 5, Extract 2, Introduction A.
Good morning.
Hi.
Can I help you? Are you looking for anything in particular?
Yes, I'm trying to get hold of a book it's a set text for first year economics. I'm afraid I can't remember the exact title, but it's by somebody called Barnaby, I think.
Oh, yes, I know it. It's by Barnabas and Bailey.
Introduction B.
Welcome to this week's edition of The Sports Show. Today we're going to look at the role of the sports coach in elite sport. In the studio we have a group of young athletes and two coaches from two very different sports, football and gymnastics. And let's go first to Charlie McPhee, who's been coaching young footballers for over 25 years. Charlie, welcome to the programme.
My pleasure.
Introduction C.
Okay, everyone, let's get started. We've got three tutorial papers to get through in the next hour, so who's going first?
We are, Dr. Matthews. Kathy and I are doing a joint presentation this week.
Oh, yes, of course. And can you just remind the rest of the group what area of the media you've chosen to research?
Yes, well, we've been looking at the effect of television on young children.
Right. Over to you.
Introduction D.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce our guest to you, John Watson. We're delighted to have John with us today to share his views on conservation. As environmental science students, I know you'll have a lot of questions, so let's kick off by asking him to tell us how he got involved in the environmental movement.
Thank you, Deborah. It's nice to be here.
Introduction E.
Welcome to this week's edition of Frontiers of Science. The International Space Station, the ISS, is a floating laboratory 350 kilometers above the Earth. But what exactly is it, and who is behind it? To answer our questions, we are pleased to welcome to the studio Dr. Carl Richter, who is a specialist in the field of space research.
Delighted to be here.
Unit 5, Extract 3.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce our guest to you, John Watson. We're delighted to have John with us today to share his views on conservation. As environmental science students, I know you'll have a lot of questions, so let's kick off by asking him to tell us how he got involved in the environmental movement.
Thank you, Deborah. It's nice to be here. When I was 7 years old, back in the 1940s, my father bought 200 acres of land on the central coast of New South Wales in eastern Australia. Well, the marvellous thing about it was that it was virgin bush. In other words, completely natural. But this kind of country doesn't exist anymore.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let me explain. We went to live there when I was 10. When I was 12, the foxes and cats appeared. By the time I was 14, there were no native animals left.
You mean that within 4 years, all the native animals had gone?
That's exactly what I mean. But it took a while for people to realise what was going on.
So you're saying that it was the cat and the fox that killed off the native animals?
Absolutely right. But back in the 1970s, people didn't realise it. Even though Australia was losing wildlife faster than the rest of the world combined, people were blaming the farmers and miners, but not their lovely little pussycats.
They're domestic cats you're talking about.
Exactly. And what's more, they didn't want to know.
Can you tell us how you set about proving your theory that it was feral cats and foxes which were killing native animals?
Well, I moved to South Australia specifically to set up a wildlife sanctuary there.
Why South Australia in particular?
Well, I chose South Australia because it was the only state where it was still legal for me to fence off an area and put back locally extinct animals.
That was very far-sighted of them, wasn't it?
Well, not exactly. They just hadn't got around to making it illegal. No, they soon tried to, once they realised what I was doing.
Did you ever get into trouble for your actions?
Oh, yes, once or twice. In 1976, they put me in jail for cutting down some pine trees to allow me to build a fence to keep out the cats and foxes.
How did you get out of that situation?
Oh, well, I signed an agreement saying I wouldn't go on building the sanctuary. But then I just kept on building it.
Oh, that was very brave of you.
Well, I figured that I'd signed under duress, so I didn't feel bound by it. The sanctuary was completed in 1983 and opened to the public in 1985. And within a year, it was overrun with native animals.
There are other ways of protecting endangered animals, though, aren't there? You can raise public awareness through research and educational programs.
Well, I don't have much time for that. Unfortunately, today we measure success in science not by your results, but by how much funding you get.
What you've done is obviously admirable, but don't you think there's an argument for letting nature take its course? I mean, don't you think cats and foxes have a right to live too?
Well, no, not really. They were introduced to this country, but they don't belong here.
But aren't you trying to turn back the clock? These other animals are here now. What is so important to you about native species that justifies killing any number of alien ones?
Well, I believe that evolution gave us a paradise, and that we will lose everything unless we understand the need for balance. But really, at the end of the day, it's just a belief. It's just a feeling.
Unit 6, Extract 1. A.
Even though I told her not to bother, my friend insisted on driving me to the airport.
B.
On top of everything else, we now have to worry about my sick grandmother too.
C. Finally, before we go, I'd just like to thank you all for coming along to the meeting this evening. D.
No matter what you do, you can't avoid growing older each year, but for your own sake, you can at least try to stay fit.
E.
As a result of the burglary, we have decided to put bars on the windows.
F.
Not only is the new law going to make it more expensive to smoke cigarettes, it's also going to discourage young people from taking it up in the first place, which has to be a good thing.
G. People always think that foreign languages are spoken much faster than their own language. For example, they say, "Don't New Yorkers speak fast?" But in reality, it's just a problem of understanding.
Unit 6, Extract 2.
Welcome to this week's edition of Frontiers of Science. The International Space Station, the ISS, is a floating laboratory 350 kilometers above the Earth. But what exactly is it, and who is behind it? To answer our questions, we are pleased to welcome to the studio Dr. Carl Richter, who is a specialist in the field of space research.
Delighted to be here.
Dr. Richter, who is behind this venture?
The International Space Station, the ISS, is a joint venture between America, Russia, Japan, Canada, Brazil, and the 15 nations of the European Space Agency.
So that's 18, 19, 20 countries in all.
Yes, that's correct. And on top of that, it's the largest and most complex international scientific project in history.
Wow. And can you tell us how much it's going to cost?
Well, despite the fact that it was estimated to cost $120 billion, it has already gone $8 billion over budget. So now we're looking at $128 billion.
And what size will it be?
Well, it will measure 108 meters across by 88 meters long, with almost half a hectare of solar panels powering six scientific laboratories.
Okay, so it's no small venture, is it? Now, I must ask you this question. What do they do about water on board?
Good question. Well, nothing goes to waste, but hygiene in space is a complex affair. Because of the impracticality of transporting large amounts of liquid into space, they've come up with some ingenious solutions. For instance, everything on board, including the laboratory rats, loses water when it exhales or sweats. The humidity goes through a condensation process before being returned to the water supply.
I see.
If they didn't reuse the water, the station would need about 20,000 kilograms of water a year, which just couldn't be done.
Going back to the laboratories, what's going to be happening there?
Well, we'll have teams of astronaut scientists working in the labs, and research will include, for example, tissue culture, studying life in low gravity, the nature of space, observations of the Earth from space, with a view to improving our maps, and the development of new commercial products.
I can't imagine what it must be like to live without gravity, though we've probably all seen those pictures of people trying to eat and drink in a state of weightlessness.
Indeed. And, of course, in addition to this, we don't really know what the long-term mental effects on the human psyche will be. So that is a particular area of interest.
Can you give us an idea of what life is like on board? What's the daily routine for the astronauts?
Well, you need to be real good friends with the others because it's a small place. The first chore of the day each morning is to ensure all is well with the many systems. Then this is followed by breakfast, which is timed to take precisely 45 minutes. Experts have decided that togetherness around the dining table is psychologically important. So meals of pre-packed food are eaten together.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mail received overnight is read around the breakfast table, followed by a daily conference. So meetings are inescapable, even in space.
And what about recreational time?
It's pretty brief, and facilities are minimal. But for instance, some astronauts prefer to read. Others listen to CDs. One guy, I understand, just used to stare out of the window. Each day, in order to offset the ill effects of being cooped up in the astronauts' environment, they have 2 hours set aside for exercise. Work rosters occupy 6 12-hour days each week. Sundays are for rest and communication via emails and video conferencing with family back home on Earth.
So how is the schedule progressing? Is the project on time?
So-so. The first two components, which are known as the Unity module and the Zarya module, were launched in 1998 and were then joined together. Joining them together took 12 days.
Incredible. I don't know how they do that stuff.
And the next stage took place in May 1999, when the space shuttle Discovery and its crew delivered 2 tons of equipment. This has been stored awaiting the arrival of the first crew.
Okay. And how do the astronauts actually survive?
There's a Russian supply module which was attached in July 2000. It provides air, water, and food for the astronauts, as well as electricity for experiments.
You mentioned that the ISS is already over budget. Mm. Will this affect the estimated time of completion?
Yes, unfortunately it will in a way. Initially, they had hoped to be able to put as many as 7 astronauts up there at any one time, but they're now going to be limited to 3. However, we hope to have this smaller station complete by 2006.
Well, Dr. Richter, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you for coming on the program.
Unit 7, Extract 1. A.
Heat always tends to move from places where there is a lot of heat to places where there is not quite so much. The transfer of heat from one place to another can be brought about in 3 ways, namely conduction, convection, and radiation.
B.
How intelligent are you? It's a question psychologists often ask, but now, two mathematicians argue that it's meaningless. They say their experiments with computer mini-brains prove that intelligence depends on the environment and can't exist independently of it. The work has reignited a fierce debate on the nature of intelligence.
C.
Who were the first astronomers? Humans have always looked to the sky, trying to understand the celestial bodies that sweep across it. The ancient Greeks were the first to record their observations and apply them to calculate the size of Earth and its relativity to the Moon and the Sun. Then, in the 2nd century AD, Ptolemy concluded that Earth was the center of the universe, a philosophy generally accepted for 1500 years.
D.
We all have our image of the Amazon. For some, it's a romantic place where the world's greatest river, its largest rainforest, and its most diverse ecosystems coexist in harmony. For others, it's a place echoing to the sound of chainsaws, turned to ashes by farmers, and defiled by mercury spewing from gold mines.
E.
A ballad is a narrative poem which tells a story, usually an exciting story, and one which also conveys an idea about the time in which it was written. Ballads date back hundreds of years to the days when books were rare, and so people would tell stories instead. Many of the first ballads told tales of courage, superstition, and mystery.
F.
It seems that languages have one single purpose, to communicate thought. Nevertheless, this aim is achieved in many different ways. As far as we can tell, there is no aspect of grammar or syntax that is universal, or without which we cannot create language.
Unit 7, Extract 2.
The famous scientist Charles Darwin worked and worried incessantly, so much so that he made himself ill. His wife Emma, meanwhile, was intelligent, liked literature, and not only did she dance gracefully, she spoke French, German, and Italian well, and played the piano brilliantly. Emma Darwin was born Emma Wedgwood, one of eight children from the well-to-do Wedgwood pottery family, famous to this day for their fine plates and chinaware. Charles was, in fact, her first cousin, as his mother had also been a Wedgwood. Emma coped well in society, whereas Charles did not. He wasn't in the least bit interested in music, nor did he have time to read anything but science. Nevertheless, by all accounts, Emma made a successful and happy career after the marriage, and gave birth to 10 children between the years 1839 and 1856. Her life has been documented in a recently published biography called Behind Every Great Man, and we are pleased to welcome the author to our studio today.
Unit 7, Extract 3, A.
Who was Ptolemy? Do you know who Ptolemy was?
B.
When were the pyramids built? Can you tell me when the pyramids were built?
Unit 7, Extract 4.
Good morning, everybody. Now, last week we were looking at the positive effects that computers have had on our society. This week I'd like to talk about one of the negatives, computer viruses. Okay, so what is a computer virus? Well, it is a software program that has been designed, tested, and released by a human programmer with the single intention of corrupting and destroying useful programs. Put in simple terms, it's a way of causing lots of trouble for ordinary people just to be a nuisance. It's known as a virus because, although it's not a biological organism, it functions in a similar way, in that it seeks out a host, that is, a body in which to live and multiply, your computer, with the end result of destroying that host. Let's go back 50 years. In 1949, in the early days of computer technology, John Van Neumann presented the first model of a computer virus program in his paper Theory and Organization of Complicated Automata, 1949. Soon after this paper was published, we find reference to a game known as Core Wars. Core Wars was initially created for the intellectual entertainment by three Americans working on large mainframe computers. Remember, in those days, computers were the size of a couple of rooms. By the 1980s, at the small sum of $2 postage, anyone could get details on how to play Core Wars. And very soon after, we see the emergence of a new pastime, one where people spent time creating programs that could escape the game and destroy other programs. In this way, the first computer viruses were born. Like their biological counterparts, computer viruses are picked up through casual habits. Virus programs are often intentionally placed within useful programs in the public domain, or they're included in software which is not official. That is, software that you might have acquired on the black market, which of course you don't do. It seems quite hard to believe that anyone would go to this level of deceit to intentionally corrupt the data of others, but the rise in the number of computer software infections and the amount of lost data that we are seeing these days is proof that these virus programmers are going to extremes to do just that. They are going out of their way to create programs that hide inside legitimate software applications and cause all sorts of errors that the average end user will then mistake for hardware failure. In other words, they will think that the problem lies with their own computer. So, what can we do to combat these people? Well, the first thing is to realize that virus programmers succeed because people are not always careful about where they get their programs from. So, number one, be very careful. And I don't just mean that you should be careful about the source of your software. You also need to take care with emails and avoid any messages which are suspicious looking. For instance, a message that says, "I love you," or "win $50. So the second golden rule is avoid trouble. Now, there are other things we can do to protect ourselves. We can try to find out exactly how the viruses work, how they accomplish their aims. In other words, we need to understand them. And, of course, there is a good selection of antivirus software available on the market now, as well as on the internet, to combat the virus plague. So another way of protecting ourselves and our computers is to be well prepared. And before I leave you, let me just say that if you ever run into one of those virus guys, tell them what you think of them.
Unit 7, Extract 5.
Harnessing the sun's energy, that is, using the sun to generate power, can be difficult. But these days, increasing use is being made of the energy from the sun, particularly to heat homes and provide hot water. In particular, we are seeing an increase in the use of individualized heating units to serve the needs of individual households. Have a look at this diagram. It represents solar panels, which are fixed to the roof of a house to capture, if you like, the sun's energy. It is typical of any system which uses a solar panel to provide hot water. So how does it work? Well, energy from the sun travels to the earth in the form of radiation. This can be visible radiation, which is another way of saying light. We also receive invisible radiation, which is known as infrared. A lot of this radiation passes through the glass at the front of the solar panel, here on the roof, and hits the surface at the back. This surface is black because black is good at absorbing radiation, and so the black surface becomes hot. Energy, in the form of heat, is conducted along the back of the solar panel to these copper pipes. Now, these pipes are filled with a liquid which in turn becomes hot. This can be either oil or water, though oil is usually used. The oil expands and rises up the pipe into the energy exchanger, which is located up here in the water tank. Sometimes we have to use a pump as well to help the liquid along. It's a remarkably efficient system when you think about it.
Speaking. Unit 1. Extract 1.
Yes, well, I grew up in a city called Victoria. It's the capital of the state of British Columbia in Canada. It's actually not on the mainland, but on a large island just to the west of Vancouver called Vancouver Island. Because in fact, just to confuse everyone, Vancouver itself is not on Vancouver Island, but on the mainland. Victoria has a pretty good climate, usually quite warm, and certainly much better than the eastern states of Canada. I think it's a great place to grow up. Not too big, not too small, with some really lovely architecture.
And the island itself is just so beautiful, once you get out of the city, that is. These days, the island is pretty famous for its ecotourism, in particular whale watching. The best time to see the whales is from May to September, so lots of tourists come to the island in summer. I think Victoria is popular predominantly because it's safe, clean, and of course the people are very friendly. If you go to Victoria, you have to visit the gardens, called the Butchart Gardens. Even if you're not really into gardens, you just have to go there.
I was born in Melbourne, in Victoria. Victoria is a state in southeast Australia. Melbourne is a really Victorian city with lots of fine examples of 19th century architecture. We're very proud of all our civic buildings and the way the city is, like, laid out. You know, with wide streets and avenues. We're also very proud of our trams. Not like Sydney, which got rid of its trams in the 60s. Melbourne has always kept the trams. And this gives the city a kind of, well, a kind of European feel. In fact, my grandfather was a tram driver. There's almost been a lot of rivalry between Melbourne and Sydney, and, well, I suppose they are very different. We like to think we're, you know, a bit more elegant in Melbourne. Smarter clothes, better restaurants, that sort of thing. But the climate is pretty extreme. In the summer, it can be incredibly hot, 35, even 40 degrees Celsius. And in the winter, well, it's often freezing, because there's nothing really much between us and Antarctica. And we even have our own little penguins to prove it.
Speaking. Unit 1. Extract 2.
I grew up in a city called Victoria. It's the capital of the state of British Columbia in Canada. Victoria has a pretty good climate, usually quite warm, and certainly much better than the eastern states of Canada. I think it's a great place to grow up. Not too big, not too small, with some really lovely architecture. And the island itself is just so beautiful, once you get out of the city, that is. I think Victoria is popular predominantly because it's safe, clean, and of course the people are very friendly.
Speaking. Unit 1. Extract 3.
Island. Climate. Architecture. 19th century architecture. Popular. Restaurants. Friendly. Rivalry. Whale watching. Wide streets. A European feel. Ecotourism. Breathtakingly. Predominantly. Certainly. Incredibly.
Speaking. Unit 2. Extract 1.
I really like rock music. These days you can find a lot of good music on the internet, and that's fantastic.
I really only listen to classical music and opera. To be honest with you, I find modern music quite unbearable. It's just a terrible noise as far as I'm concerned.
Actually, my favourite kind of music is film music. I enjoy listening to the soundtracks of movies, especially when I've really enjoyed the film.
Speaking. Unit 2. Extract 2.
I just love skiing. I've been doing it since I was 6 years old, so it comes pretty naturally to me now. But it can be dangerous for people who take it up later in life. And yes, it's pretty common for people to get quite badly injured, you know, broken arms and legs. In particular, knee injuries are really common, and they can be quite nasty. Or you can easily run into a tree, or get lost in the snow if you aren't careful. All part of the fun. But, you know what I love about skiing is the solitude. the challenge of the mountain. There's nothing anywhere near as exhilarating as the feeling you get when you're hurtling down the side of a mountain. The sense of freedom is amazing. Just you against nature. It beats any team sport, in my opinion.
Well, my favourite sport is rowing. I row in an eight. There are eight of us in the boat, plus the cox who steers the boat and shouts at us a lot. It's really hard work when you first start, because you get terrible blisters on your hands and your muscles really ache, especially your leg muscles. And you have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to be on the water by 5. But after a few weeks you get used to that. Most of my friends think I'm mad, and I know they say, what does she see in this? But you know, it's such a good feeling being out on the water early in the morning. And when we're working well together, you know, all eight of us working really well as a team, it's just a marvellous sense of satisfaction, and the best thing of all is winning.
Speaking. Unit 3. Extract 1.
Melbourne Zoo is probably one of the best zoos I've ever been to, and I'm not that keen on zoos normally, because it's a very open zoo. It's near the centre of the city, next to the botanical gardens, and it's really worth a visit. I actually went there with my family, with my husband and the children during the last school holidays, and they were very impressed because, for instance, you can see the lions from a bridge. You walk across the top of them, and they appear to be quite free, roaming around underneath you. So are the elephants. In fact, they are separated by a kind of moat which has water in it, and it means that they can't get across it, but the impression that you have is that the animals are actually quite free. The zoo has a great variety of animals, and you can see all sorts of creatures from all over the world. Though, of course, a particular emphasis on Australia, on Australian animals. One interesting thing is that they've kept an old 19th century building, originally built as a monkey cage, as a reminder of how the zoo used to be. But these days, the monkeys have a much better enclosure, and the zoo prides itself on its humanitarian approach. I think it's probably one of the best zoos in the world.
Speaking. Unit 3. Extract 2.
Many years ago, when I was in South Africa, I visited a wildlife park called Thimbivati in Natal Province. I went with my two aunts and my sister, and we flew into the park in a small plane from Johannesburg, northeast. And as we were landing on the strip, we had to take off again because there was a giraffe on the strip. It was so exciting being there. There were no modern buildings, we just had one guide, and there were six other people with us. And we lived in little mud huts for 4 days. It was really exciting. We felt as though we were completely on our own, although we had the security of having a guard with a gun. He said he'd never had to use it. I felt very privileged to be there with all the animals around us and only six other people besides us. The guard took us out at dawn and then again at dusk, because that's when you're most likely to see the animals. We also went out at night once or twice, and that was really amazing. Quite frightening, though, because you'd see all these little eyes all around you, peering at you. We saw lions, elephants, giraffes, gazelle, everything. It was absolutely marvellous.
Speaking. Unit 5. Extract 1. A.
I believe there are a number of good reasons for keeping animals in a zoo. One is that you can see animals from other countries. Animals you would never see in the wild. And zoos are really great for children, because they can have the chance to see unusual animals.
B.
Personally, I don't like zoos. I can't see the point in them. You can see animals on the television if that's what you want.
C.
Well, I can see a number of benefits. Firstly, they give us the chance to observe animal behaviour, and they also help us protect certain species of animal, like the panda bear, for instance, animals which may be under threat in the wild.
D.
I'm afraid I can't see any real benefits, at least not in the case of zoos, though I may be wrong. Wildlife parks, on the other hand, are probably more useful because they can actually help to protect animals from poachers or when there are environmental disasters such as drought. E.
I tend to think zoos can be of enormous benefit, but not just so that we can see rare and exotic beasts or animals, but because they act as a kind of research laboratory. But if I had my way, I'd probably keep the people out of the zoos, just keep them for the animals.
F.
There may be good things for us humans, but I can't see what the poor animals get out of it. I mean, would you want to be stuck in a cage all day?
G.
I think the benefits of keeping animals in a zoo are that we can see animals such as lions and tigers or kangaroos, which you wouldn't normally see. Well, not where I come from anyway. But some people think it's really cruel, and they may have a point.